Hello and welcome. In episode 34 of University Registrar's Talking About Stuff, I have an interesting half an hour chatting about stuff with Steve Knight, who's been Chief Operating Officer at the University of Sunderland for 6 years now. Steve has had a distinctive career journey, which started with a 26-year stint in the RAF, followed by time at Middlesex University and in the private sector before arriving at Sunderland. We explore the cultural differences and also, perhaps surprisingly, the many similarities between higher education and the services before discussing the development of health provision at Sunderland and its impressive progress in opening up a new medical school. Steve is frank about the significant problems presented to the university by a major cyber attack in October, which meant that they had to shut down all IT systems and then recover from there, taking 4 to 6 weeks to get fully up and running again. The attack meant that everyone realised how dependent on technology all operations were, and how important it was to have backup plans and alternative communications channels available. This is an increasingly common issue in the sector, and Steve has some really sensible advice for all institutions on preparing for and responding to such situations. This was not the only challenge which faced Sunderland, though, and came on top of both the ongoing COVID response and major structural damage following Storm Arwen. We also talk more broadly about the impressive achievements of university staff in the face of the pandemic and some of the new challenges Steve predicts coming down the track for the sector in the months and years ahead. All in all, a really good conversation, and I do hope you like it. Right, hello everyone, and welcome to the latest edition of University Registrar's Talking About Stuff. And this time it's my immense pleasure to speak to Steve Knight, who's at the University of Sunderland. Now, Steve, you need to tell me first what your actual title is, because everyone's got different titles in our jobs and no two people are the same. So what's your particular title?
So, Paul, I am the Chief Operating Officer here. I've got quite a broad Chief Operating Officer remit, from finance all the way through to estates and various other things.
Great. So it's a broad portfolio.
Yes.
Okay. And in terms of your institution, you've been there how long? But you've had a varied career trajectory, haven't you?
Yes. Well, actually, this May, I'll have been here 6 years, which is quite amazing. My career started out actually from quite a young age in the Royal Air Force. I did 26 years in the Royal Air Force. I left in 2005, joined Middlesex University as it was called the Deputy Vice Chancellor of Corporate Services, but effectively as a COO role. Did that for 8 years and then nipped out to the private sector, where I worked for Michelin and then Kier for 3 years before then, almost without a break, ending up here at Sunderland.
Fantastic. So the RAF experience then, what were you doing in the RAF?
So I was,
you must have had a variety of roles.
Yeah, so I was what they called at the time, it's changed now slightly, an administrative officer. So I basically did corporate services in the Royal Air Force. So imagine a large airport. I looked after everything that wasn't engineering or flying operations. So all administration, catering, estate, whatever. So when I came into the higher education section, I had pretty much the entire remit of professional services within HE that I'd dealt with for 26 years in the Royal Air Force around the world. So I had quite a varied background.
So what about the cultural differences then? You know, because the traditions, you would on the surface, you'd think, you know, the kind of, you know, RAF, very command and control, very directive, clear lines of accountability, no questions asked. Whereas HE is, of course, the very opposite of that. But is it really that different?
Not really. I mean, what you've got to realise, of course, is the RAF is one of the most technologically advanced services. So unlike maybe the Army, for example, you get questioned as an officer in the Royal Air Force much more than you would in other services. And you rule by consent, so to speak, rather than direction all the time. Also, I did, at the back end of my career, about 8 years on and off in the Ministry of Defence in London in various roles, and running joint civil service and service teams in policy jobs in the MOD. And once you've dealt with the three single services in the civil service, coming in to deal with academics and others in higher education is not that is not that different. So you had to get used to the differences in HE, but I found it a reasonably smooth transition.
Oh, that's, I mean, because I think people will be a bit surprised about that, and you know, they'll have the same kind of preconceptions as I do. But actually, as you say, the RAF, indeed all the services, are very sophisticated organisations, aren't they? And it's not just about, you know, telling people to march that way and fire the other way, is it?
Well, there's a bit of that, but there's a bit of that, and there are moments for that. But in the main, there are some very intelligent people at all levels in the Royal Air Force and indeed the Army and the Royal Navy now. And, you have to manage in a certain way to get the best out of people.
Yeah. Yeah. So would you ever go back to the services?
No, Paul, I left that behind. indeed, I was one of those people who left mid career. So I was, rising up the ranks, doing all the right things, but I just decided in my early 40s that 26 years was enough. I was stuck a bit in London, commuting in and out of London, and decided I wanted to go on to somewhere where I could do both strategic stuff and operational stuff, which is what I enjoyed. And so I took the decision and just resigned and looked for another job. That's how I moved on.
And then you ended up at Middlesex. Yeah.
And then ended up at Middlesex, which at the time was professionally good, domestically bad, because I lived in Harrogate. But as a transition job out of the Royal Air Force, it was a fantastic job. And I ended up, I wasn't going to stay for 8 years, but I ended up staying for 8 years.
And then you did your 3 years in the private sector. So what was different? I mean, was that a very different experience again from Middlesex?
Yes. I mean, I did it for two reasons. One is I had to break away from Middlesex, and the job I got in the private sector enabled me to effectively work from home. I didn't work at home, but it was designated a home-based role, so I effectively moved up north. But also, I just hadn't worked in the private sector before, and I thought I'd give it a go. The reason I only did 3 years in the private sector was because 2 years in, we got taken over by the Kia Group. That's not the car, that's the construction industry.
Yeah. And I
experienced a takeover, which then caused a major restructuring. And without going into all the detail, it wasn't a suitable role that I liked, and I left. I wasn't expecting to jump straight back into higher education, but literally, as I arrived at King's Cross on my last day to go home, a headhunter called me, and 3 weeks later, I was in front of the Vice Chancellor in Sunderland. It was that quick.
Yeah, well, occasionally higher education can move rapidly.
Yes.
Oh, well, that's great. And you've been there for 6 years now, you say. So tell me about Sunderland as a university, because, it's established in 92, presumably got a kind of strong technological college heritage before that. But what's distinctive and special about Sunderland?
It was quite interesting coming here because I was in a large London post 92 before I came here. Sunderland is about half the size, about 20,000 students. But very much anchored in the city. I sit here in my office on the fourth floor of one of the buildings, looking out over the city with actually the snow and wind lashing against my window. I'd never actually worked in the Northeast or even been to Sunderland before I came here. And it is a really actually friendly place. The university itself really cares for its students. As I said, it's anchored in the city. It's a major player in the city. We are going through major regeneration in the city now. I've had a thoroughly enjoyable 6 years. The university has been building up its health faculty for many years. And 3 years ago, some colleagues will be aware, we actually won the bid to open a medical school. So we're now 3 years into that. We're known, I think, around the region, certainly for health, education and a few other things. But no, it was quite interesting for me moving from one institution to another and seeing the differences as I moved.
So tell me about the medical school then, because is that in partnership with an existing medical school, or is it how is it set up then?
So we bidded in the last round for a slightly different type of medical school, which is fully integrated into our health faculty. It doesn't stand alone, it's part of the health faculty. We bidded for, we got all the students we bidded for. We are delivering our own degrees. We are buddied up with Keele because you've got to have a buddy to start. Yeah. We're not part of, like I believe Lincoln is part of Nottingham. We are standalone, and we will be at 500 medical students in the next couple of years when we're full swing. It's been quite interesting opening a medical school. Some of my colleagues, like yourself, explained to me when this first happened what came with a medical school in terms of the General Medical Council and other things. But we are working through all of that. The medical students also bring a different type of student to the university. We are being a post-92 community student type organisation. We have a different student base. They bring a, if I can put it plainly, a much younger cohort in. But it's going really well, and we're actually just about to open our brand new cadaveric facility that we've just built.
So that's been interesting. Oh, good.
That's been interesting in itself, going through all of that. But no, it's going very well, and we're very pleased with it.
Oh, that's terrific to hear. Now, I do remember talking to you about it. Because it used to be in, before the new medical schools started in the past 10 years or so, there was a real attempt in the 90s and the early 2000s for universities that didn't have a medical school, particularly long established universities, to try and get one. It was seen as a real kind of mark of confirmation of status, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, one of the things that vice chancellors always used to say to each other at the time is, you really don't want a medical school unless you want to lose an awful lot of money. Because they all cost. I think that is a different world now. I mean, it is an expensive business, but I think that the nature of the operation now is that there's more realism about the actual funding required to start up a new school, because quite a few have done it.
Yeah, I mean, we had to go through a very torturous process with the then HEFCE to prove that the medical school wouldn't drag us down financially. Yeah. And I spent many a fun hour talking to to certain colleagues in HEFCE with spreadsheets all over the table, and we monitored it very closely at the start. I mean, we've been a little bit clever in that everything we build for the medical school we also use for the rest of the health faculty.
Yeah.
So we've got both wet and dry anatomy and some quite high tech, for example, Amitage tables, all this sort of stuff, and it is used across the faculty from paramedics to nurses to medical students. So it is expensive, and but it's how you manage it, I think.
But I think that we know the nation needs more doctors, more health professionals more generally. We also need to know that they need to work together in teams in the same place, instead of having those historical artificial divides between different categories of staff. So it sounds like part of your ethos is actually addressing that particular future.
It is. I mean, we had two or three big focuses on the medical school. One was to open up access to groups that were finding difficulty getting into other schools. So we have a different entry procedure. Secondly, we wanted, as you say, to integrate the whole school into that. And the third one was, and this was part of the government response, was to try and hold doctors in areas where they traditionally weren't across the country. And our focus is on GPs. So it's very focused on that line, and Sunderland and the North East is one of the areas where traditionally there's been a shortage. So we address that as part of the bid. Time will tell, of course, but we so far so good.
Yeah. Oh, well, it's terrific to hear, Steve. So I'm really glad you're making progress on that front. And as you say, good for the city, good for the region as well. I wanted to ask you about an issue which Sunderland was in the news for not that long ago, and it might be a bit painful, but I'll ask it nevertheless. I mean, we're conscious that lots of universities are seen as targets for cyber attacks of one kind or another, and I think the latest data shows that there were over 50 significant cyber attacks on university in the last 12 months. But Sunderland, I think, suffered a particularly damaging one quite recently. What actually happened?
Well, on the morning of the 12th of October, it is seared in my brain. As I pulled up in the car park at 7:45, my deputy director of IT called me to say we'd had a cyber attack. And to cut a long story short, we then had to shut down all our systems.
Everything?
Everything. And then we built back from there. We managed actually to get back within 4 to 6 weeks, which was good. And we have learned an awful lot of lessons from this. Ironically, we have been building up with the training and everything for a number of years. Only a week and a half before this happened, we had a full executive desktop exercise on a cyber attack, which proved to be really useful when it actually happened. And in fact, it took me a few hours to persuade my senior colleagues that it actually wasn't an exercise. What I would say, I'll be hopefully briefing colleagues on who are in more detail going forward. What I would say is it is a when, not an if. And colleagues probably need to understand that. I would also say that as much preparation and resilience that you can put in ahead of it happening is important. And we've been doing that for 3 or 4 years. Backup plans like communications are important. So when you take down your email, your Teams, and every other communication channel you are used to using, what do you do next? Discuss. And the other thing is to realize how much we all rely on technology now, particularly with COVID going online, et cetera, et cetera. But not just that, we discovered that, of course, technology runs everything. So one of the first issues I was faced with as I walked in the building was my cafe manager looking at me saying, all my tills have stopped working, and a big queue. I then had a fire alarm issue. The fire alarm stopped working. The building management systems went down. I can go on. So we have created during the process a whole lessons learned here. And there were many things that we were going to do anyway over the next few months.
Yeah.
But it's a real lesson actually for everybody. And you're right. I got to talk to a whole lot of agencies I never knew existed when this happened. And organizations, educational organizations, are being hit, I think, at the rate of one a week at the moment. And some are more prepared than others. And if you are not prepared, it can be disastrous, particularly if you haven't got good backups. And we did have good backups, and we were able to recover. So I think this will become a bigger issue across the sector going forward. And we're all going to need to look at how much investment we put into our tech. And we're increasing our investment now on this side.
It's not just about the tech, it's about people's behaviours as well, isn't it? I mean, you talked about the education programme you've been through, but people actually do need to take this really seriously. And I know that we've got colleagues who regard it as a bit of a pain, a bit of an imposition, a waste of their time, etc. But the cost to them, to individual researchers or administrators, of not having access to their system for weeks could be massive, right? Compared with the half an hour it takes to do an online cybersecurity task.
Yeah, absolutely. Imagine suddenly that you've got access to nothing and your laptop has stopped working. Right? That's what happened to everybody. We had to rebuild every single laptop and desktop in the university.
It's huge.
It's huge. And I can talk about it now because we're still sort of at the tail end of it, but we're out of it. But it is thing. The first thing I did was grab an A4 notepad out of the cupboard. And that's what I worked off for a week. So it was really interesting. I think the biggest issue for me initially was communication. You know, it's confusing, but actually trying to communicate with all your staff and students in the first few hours when you don't have any communication channels is really difficult. We did it. We switched communication channels.
So what semaphore? What did you go for?
So, for example, we replaced Teams with Zoom within a few hours. We used channels like WhatsApp, other multimedia channels. We set up a separate emergency website where we posted stuff. Now we're gonna lock all this in now, but I think everybody needs to understand, you know, that when this happens, it is totally confusing, and you know, not everything works. But some people things were working, some people things weren't working, depending on what build you had. Yeah, there's a whole lot of confusion going on, and you know, it can really disable. Well, it did for a few weeks, but it can seriously disable organizations. Since we were hit, of course, you've got everybody from Graf the Jewelers to the Labour Party to one a week you can see in the press. Yeah. People are getting hit all the time, and you're as safe as each individual in the organisation as well.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
All this messaging to individuals about don't press the button on that email when it comes in. Yeah, we did tests. I'm sure you do tests and other colleagues do tests.
Yeah.
And every time you do a test, people hit the wrong button. That's the way people get in. So you've just got to keep banging the drum here. But I think the overall message to me is how reliant we are on tech now. We are totally reliant.
Yeah, no, and I think your point about the coffee shop and the fire alarms and the building management system absolutely hits it home. What about teaching then? I mean, did that kind of just carry on?
My colleagues in the academy did a great job on this, because clearly our main virtual learning platform went down as well. We discovered very quickly alternative methods of teaching. The other sort of bizarre thing about this whole thing is, of course, we're in the middle of COVID when this happened.
Yeah.
So we're in the middle of COVID, it's October, and we're all trying to keep as far apart from each other as possible. The first thing I did was ask everybody to come into the same room, because it's the only thing you can do.
Yeah.
And so we were able to do a bit of face-to-face, but we switched to alternative delivery modes as well. And there are things like Zoom and other things you can use. One of the lessons out of this is, what do you do if your VLE goes down?
Yeah.
What's the alternative? And we need to have it in place on the shelf, as we need to have a comms package and other packages on the shelf. I mean, we did all these things in a few hours, but actually we need them ready to go.
Yeah.
So that we know what we're switching to, you know. But yeah, it just takes over, to be honest with you. And in fact, for a whole week, I forgot about COVID completely, because this was a bigger problem.
Yeah.
And remained actually a bigger problem until Storm Arwen hit the UK. And then that blew the roof off our media centre.
No.
And took out one of our main teaching buildings. So we now had COVID overlaid by cyber, overlaid, I think in November or whenever it was, by no roof on the media centre.
Goodness
so we
me.
Had we had quite a few instances running up to Christmas, which was quite interesting in itself. And the university had to deal with this with a sort of overall resilience just before Christmas.
Yeah. Oh, it's an incredible tale, and you know, one, as you say, that you've learned lessons from, but actually the rest of the sector needs to learn some lessons from too. So I'm looking forward to hearing more through the network about that. Can I just moving on a little bit? I mean, we mentioned COVID in passing a couple of times then. So we're nearly kind of 2 years from the first lockdown. What's your kind of looking back from where we are now? What's your kind of feeling about, you know, how the university and the community responded and, you know, where people's heads are at now and what we think is going to happen in the next few months.
Yeah. So I've led the university response for a couple of years now and sort of lived and breathed COVID. And I was reflecting on this ahead of our conversation today. I mean, I think this institution has done a fantastic job responding to COVID. I've got a really dedicated COVID team that has worked with me. My colleagues at all levels across the university, you know, changing the guidance every time the government changes the guidance and whatever.
Yeah.
But we've also here done something slightly different to other universities in the sector. We didn't join the university testing plan or whatever. We work with the local authority.
Yeah.
So we, all the way through, we have worked in tandem with the local authority, set up testing sites on the university, et cetera, et cetera. And that has worked really well. And our partnership within the city has enabled us to work well. And most of our students, of course, live in the city or the region. So that's fine. The other thing we've been able to do is keep face-to-face teaching going. With our large medical and health faculty, we pretty much, the students have worked through the pandemic, as I'm sure they have in other institutions. And we've kept that going. I think the sort of key learnings for me out of this are another point about resilience. This has been a long haul, and I think it's affected both staff and students. I think there's been quite a lot of frustration at times with late notification of rule changes and changing guidelines and whatever. We've had obviously an uncertainty of things like, are we going to get student recruitment? Are the finances going to work out? I mean, early on in the pandemic, we were predicting a 26 million loss as a result of this. Now, as it happened, we didn't go that far. You know, we've actually in a good financial position. But there's been huge uncertainty, particularly around international students during the pandemic. Yeah. There's also been a huge risk, a variance of risk appetite amongst staff and students, depending on who you are, what your outlook on life is. The other thing I would say is speed of change, which has come up in a number of forms. I mean, we've moved as a sector and as a university faster than could ever imagine. I mean, some of the things we did in the first few weeks would have taken years.
Yeah.
You know, we just about introduced Teams as the pandemic struck. And we became experts in about 4 weeks. That would have taken years. You know, years. So I think we've moved to agile working. We've got all sorts of issues now to sort out about on campus and how it's going to work and all this sort of stuff. But I think there is a weariness now about this. There certainly was leading up to Christmas, and I've come back like the day after, having had 2 weeks off, and straight back into it, you know, changing rules and more comms and whatever. I think as a university, we've had a pretty good war, so to speak, on this.
Yeah.
We came pretty high up in a student poll as to how we'd manage COVID. We've communicated endlessly throughout the pandemic. We've also been open and transparent, which David Bell, my vice chancellor, is very keen on. And so we've been absolutely upfront with everybody in the university community. But I have to say, personally, it's getting a bit of a drag now, and I shall not be sorry if it ends at some point, Paul.
I'm sure it will. It will end. You're absolutely right. But I mean, it's great to hear that response. It's one of those things that, you know, yes, despite the hardships and everything, it has brought university communities together in a way that perhaps they haven't before, although there are different perspectives as well. And one of the striking things for me is the way in which, you know, particularly those health professionals, those student health professionals stepped up and have stepped up ever since. And also the way in which students more generally have responded, you know, to, you know, what has been an incredibly difficult time for them, especially those who've, you know, lived through A-level problems and challenges at school and then come to university as well. So it has been really hard for young people in particular as well, I think. So it's been tough all round. But universities are incredibly resilient places, aren't they?
They are, and you know, I pay tribute to my colleagues in the academy for getting all the teaching online, but also the professional services colleagues who also worked, a lot of them, throughout the pandemic.
Yeah.
And while a lot of us ran and hid at home in the middle of the lockdown, you know, the security guards, the cleaners, the colleagues working in halls, etc., and others,
absolutely,
continued to work throughout.
Absolutely.
And kept the place going, actually.
Yeah. So hopefully things will get better, and hopefully that will happen sooner rather than later. But, you know, there are always challenges on the horizon, Steve. So, you know, with your crystal ball, and what do you see as the, you know, the biggest challenges ahead for, you know, for our sector?
So, I mean, obviously we've been keeping a very close eye on funding, fee levels, all that sort of stuff. I think though that the challenge for me, and I was discussing this with a colleague actually just this morning in a rare face-to-face meeting actually, so a new colleague has arrived, is around what do we do as we come out of the pandemic. So I mentioned agile working earlier,
yeah,
which we moved to, but has been rather disrupted by the pandemic. And I mentioned online versus face-to-face teaching. I think the whole model of delivery is a big challenge in my head now. Where are we going to end up? I mean, you've got people who are saying, well, it's going to be mostly online. You've got people who are saying we're going to revert to face-to-face. The answer is probably somewhere in the middle, because I don't think we're going to get students back to where they were before the pandemic. So I think we're going to have to, we really are going to have to look hard about what is the delivery model. I think the government is probably looking at higher education to certainly not be funded anymore and potentially to lose funding in a variety of ways. So we're going to have to become more efficient in how we deliver and think about this. I mentioned technology earlier. I think for me, there's a switch between estate and technology to a certain amount. So there's a number that all sort of wraps up in a how do you deliver higher education going forward. I think from a number of things have held up for us really well. I think international students have held up. Our T&E operation has held up. Online operation. I mean, there are some bits that have just carried on almost everything. But yeah. I think there are other challenges that higher education needs to get its head around as we go forward.
Yeah. Well, Steve, listen, we need to stop there, but can I thank you again for a really interesting discussion, and we've covered a lot of ground there, and I genuinely feel for you in terms of the cyber attack. But if it took your mind off COVID, you know, it's not all bad. But thank you again, Steve. It's been great talking.
Thanks very much.
That's all then from University Registrars talking about stuff this time. There'll be plenty more along in due course, and if you can't wait, then please do check out the Registrarism blog on wonky.com, where you'll find lots of higher education comment and fun and games. Until the next time.